From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today, character actor Stephen Root, who plays the handler of a hitman in the HBO series Barry. He just received his first Emmy nomination after appearing in nearly 800 TV episodes and 100 films. Root got his start doing theater in New York.
So I do a lot of, you know, off Broadway shows for a token. Literally a token. They give you a token to get there, and they give you a token to get back above 14th Street.
Among his many roles, he's played a blind DJ in the Coen brothers' Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?, a gay vampire in the HBO series True Blood. He's probably best known as the sad sack office worker Milton in the film Office Space. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album featuring jazz pianist Fred Hirsch playing his compositions with a big band, and Justin Chang reviews the new film Brittany Runs a Marathon. You might not recognize the name of our guest, Stephen Root, but chances are awfully good you've seen his work. He's a character actor who's appeared in nearly 800 TV episodes and 100 movies, in sometimes brief appearances, like one as a bank manager on Seinfeld, or his short but memorable scenes as the sad sack office worker Milton in the film Office Space. He's had several recurring roles in TV series over the years, including The West Wing, News Radio, and Justified. After decades in acting, Root has earned his first Emmy nomination for his supporting role in the HBO series Barry. It's about a veteran, played by Bill Hader, who after returning home becomes a hitman but is beginning to have second thoughts. The series has earned numerous other nominations, including one for Best Comedy Series. Well, Stephen Root, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the Emmy nomination. It's great to have you.
Oh, thanks. Appreciate it. All of us are just kind of gobsmacked with that the entire lead cast got a nomination. So we're thrilled out of our minds.
Right. Well, I've really enjoyed the series. And I thought we'd begin with a clip of your character, Monroe Fuchs, and Barry, who's played by Bill Hader. And for folks who haven't seen it, he's a former Marine sniper, right? And who has
correct.
Who has become a hitman, and you, Monroe Fuchs, are an
old friend of the father, and the guy that thought he could use that talent for, you know, as a hitman.
Right. So you manage it, you set up the hits, you collect the money. Barry's a little tormented by all this.
No, Barry's a lot tormented.
A lot tormented.
And tormented by me almost every day.
Well, let's begin with one example. I mean, this is early in the series where you come and find Barry asleep in his room after a successful hit from a guy in Rochester, I guess.
Right.
And in the conversation, we will hear you gently chide him about running up expenses, spending a little too long getting the job done in some cases. We'll hear Barry, played by Bill Hader, speak first.
Fuchs?
Hey.
How long have you been watching me sleep?
Money from the Rochester job just cleared. One less bad guy in the world, nice work. As usual, Barry.
Oh, well, he was in bed, so it wasn't work exactly.
And why did it take 2 days?
I was doing recon to make it clean.
Or relaying around the hotel room like in Sioux Falls last month or St. Paul before that. Look, these extra expenses, they add up, Barry.
Okay.
All right. Oh, God, I'm worried about you, buddy. He looks like the old Barry, where he had a purpose.
No, I think I'm just burnt out. You know, maybe I need a break.
Hey, you know what I think?
What?
I think what we should do is shake things up a little bit. You know, so instead of burning another small town hood in some snowed in Rust Belt hole, what do you say to a little trip out to sunny Los Angeles?
You came here to give me an assignment?
It's a Chechen mob. A guy by the name of Goran Pizar needs an outsider to handle something embarrassing. It's great money. Gets a lot closer to where we need to be to hang it all up Sunday.
When do you think that'll be?
The plane for L.A. leaves in 4 hours. I will have a car waiting for you at the Ontario airport.
But Ontario? Wait, isn't that like a two-hour drive?
Yeah, just, you know, fly into LAX. You gotta cover our tracks, right?
Why, because it's cheaper? Or?
Because it is smarter, Barry.
How much cheaper was it?
And that is Bill Hader and our guest Stephen Root in a scene from the HBO series Barry. You know, I love the way you're just so enthusiastic and cheery about it all, and he's kind of like immediately seeing through, so you're here giving me an assignment.
You're giving me an assignment. You don't care about me at all, but I still, yeah. My character is such a bad uncle to him. We had originally taped the pilot, and he was much more yelling and just berating him all the time, and HBO and Bill and Alec Berg, creator, decided we didn't really have a place to go with that, so we reshot some stuff and made him more into the bad uncle that he is now.
Right. There is kind of a soft or seemingly soft side here.
He's a guy that really loves Barry, but he's completely self-serving and basically evil. But you're going to see both sides, and you're going to see more of it as the show goes on.
One of the things that's funny about the series is as it unfolds, at least half of your scenes, if not more, you play with serious facial injuries. it's
that's
a rough
Alec
world.
Berg. That's Alec Berg, the creator, said, I just like seeing you with a bandage on. I think it's funny. And I said, okay, that's what we'll do.
Yeah, does it do anything to your performance to like, I mean, in one case, you've been bitten by an 8-year-old girl, right?
12. And
12, okay.
She's brilliant. She's the daughter of a stunt person. That was her first thing. She was absolutely brilliant in it. But yes, I get thrown down hills. I get punched in the face. I get my teeth shorn. And this, everything that could happen to me happens.
Do you know how many films or TV series you have acted in? Do you keep a record?
Oh, gosh, no. you can look at IMDb and say you got, a couple of hundred or 300 yeah. credits or whatever. But even that's not really, it's not representative of what you do. Because I can say I did 100 news radios. I did 256 King of the Hills, yet that's 2 credits, so you don't, it's a lot of stuff.
Plenty of work, right.
Plenty of work, plenty of good stuff.
Yeah. You, as a kid, your family moved around a lot because your dad was a construction manager, right?
He was a construction superintendent engineer on steam power plants. So we would be at a place about 1.5, 2 years at the most, and then his company, Evasco, would send him to a new place. So we would go from Muncie, Indiana, to Sioux City, Iowa, to Wichita, Kansas, to Kansas City, Missouri, to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, to Glen Rock, Wyoming. So I bounced all over. I was always the new kid.
Right. And you didn't get into acting until college. But do you think, casting around the country out like that kind of enriched your, I don't know?
It did. It enriched my just living experience, but also it prepared me for a life of a gypsy, which is basically what an actor does. You dip into different worlds every 3 days or so. You'll go do something else. So you're always the new kid on a set. And I think it prepared me for that.
So when did you pick up acting exactly? You were in college, right?
Yeah, I was in college. The last high school I had gone to was in Vero Beach, Florida. So it was cheap at that time, 1970, to go to a state college. I chose the University of Florida and went there thinking I'd be doing something in journalism or something. Since I was school photographer, enjoyed photography, and thought maybe journalism is the way to go. So did all the requisite 2-year stuff, got an AA in that, and then was taking some electives and ended up being a spear carrier in one of the main stage shows. But from that, I was picked from a lot of the student directors to do their scenes. They said, will you come in and do this? What? Oh, well, okay, I'll try it out. And immediately got the bug from that. Switched majors, and I was off to the races.
Was it the accolades, the attention, or the fun of being somebody else?
No, it really was. It felt like home. It felt like a community. These are the people I would like to hang out with. They're creative. It introduced me to, costume design and set design and everything that happens in theater. So it just was a community that felt something that I hadn't had because I'd moved around all the time.
Right. So you did a lot of years of theater after that. We're in the National Shakespeare Company, which was a touring
yes.
crew, right?
Correct.
What kinds of parts did you have? What kind of characters?
Well, it was a 12 person company. It was the best job you could get out of something called the SETCs, the Southeastern Theater Conference Tryouts, which I went to, got this job, and it's a bus and truck with a 12-person company out of New York. You rehearsed 3 shows in Woodstock, believe it or not, put them on their feet, got in a 1963 Trailways along with a very small set with pneumatic genies for your set and some curtains, and off you went to colleges all over the country. Easily the best training you could get, because you played a small room in a junior college, or you play a 5,000-seat room in West Point. And you were always triple cast in shows, unless you were playing Othello or a lead. So I was Audrey the country wench and Corin the grandpa in the same show. It was fantastic.
Wow. Yeah. Which I guess is training for being a character actor, right? I mean, you're just...
Absolutely. It couldn't be better. Then I was dumped back in New York after a couple of 3 years of that. And it's like, oh, I only have to do one part? That's piece of cake.
After a lot of years of theater, you did find your way into movies and television. And
yes.
I'm guessing you don't have to audition a lot these days, but I'm sure you did hundreds, if not thousands.
Oh, sure, as we all did. And I got pretty good at it in the 80s and 90s. But it all comes out of that training that you had in theater, where you have to be prepared to bring it for every audition, especially for a theater audition. So that was the best training you could get, but it was mostly in New York. It was mostly on the job. So I do a lot of, you know, off Broadway shows for a token, you know, literally right. A token. They give you a token to get there, and they give you a token to get back above 14th Street. Enjoy.
And a sandwich if you're lucky. Wow.
And a sandwich if you're lucky.
But when you started auditioning for TV roles, for example, I mean, you're in there with lots and lots of people. And it always struck me as interesting that if you're looking for a relatively minor part, I mean, they're not going to have tons of lines of script. They're not going to be terribly well-developed characters in the material you're given.
Mostly, and, correct.
And I wondered, is that harder because you can't really, you don't know quite how they see the character, or is it liberating because you can just start from scratch and do what you want?
Yeah, I mean, you go in with your strongest gut reading, you know, but you're always turning, mostly, I mean, when you're starting out as a character actor, you're turning straw into gold for them because you're not getting the best scripts, probably, not probably the best part. But it's liberating in terms of, yeah, I think I'm going to just try something strange and go in and enjoy it. And I like that. I like that part where I could choose my strongest character that I thought would work and go in and just play.
Right. And if it's what they're looking for, fine. If or whatever.
If not, that's fine too. You know, that's okay. As long as you're happy with your work in the room, then you can't control anything but that.
Right. You know, I remember a little guest piece you did on Seinfeld. I think this is about 95, where you're the bank manager, right? And
correct.
There's this thing that you get into with Kramer because he thinks he's owed $100 because
right.
He wasn't greeted with a hello. I watched that again getting ready for this interview. It's like a minute and 45 seconds that you're in that scene.
But I think that's true.
But I remember it. It's more than 20 years ago, and I remember it because...
Oh, that's great.
Well, there's something that you managed to bring to that character. How do
well,
you
I appreciate
do that.
That. I mean,
again.
But it's also working with great, you know, yeah. you it's not going to happen unless you're working with, you know, a great actor. And Michael was a great actor, great physical actor. But Seinfeld is an iconic show anyway. So to go in there and do a nice, relaxed performance with those guys was just a blessing. It was really fun.
Right. When you were going from theater to TV and movie casting, did you have to tone it down because you're used to like, projecting to the back row?
Oh, yeah. I was very, very guilty of that. I think the first couple of things I got were sitcoms, so I could you do an amalgamation of how much to do on a sitcom because you're still projecting for a 200-seat audience and you're projecting for the camera. So it's both. It's big and small. But when you get to an hour dramatic, that it's basically like doing a movie, so you have to be a lot smaller on camera. And my first, I think, introduction to that was L.A. Law. I went in for an audition for that. I had big glasses on. I did a big theater audition. The casting director looked at me and said, okay, take those off. Look at me. Talk to me. And that was the best lesson I ever got in pulling it back.
Do you remember what the role was and what you did with it?
It was a lawyer. But as my National Shakespeare Company director once said to me, one of the first things I ever did the scene for him. He said, wonderful, wonderful, 90% less. Mario Saletti, God bless him.
I guess it was while you were doing news radio that you started doing voiceover work for Mike Judge's animated series, King of the Hill. Right.
Exactly.
Two thing. Right.
Yeah, it was such a blessing. I mean, I think Mike had known of my work. I did a lot of Southern characters in theater and in TV, just because I'd come from the South and I ended up doing a lot of them. So he had me come in to audition for that show. The first character I did was not the guy, but then he turned me on to Bill Dotrieve, and we just had a ball.
Right. It's how different was it doing voiceover work from, you know, performing in the theater or in film?
Well, people ask me that, and I say, you know, it's not like your voice is disconnected from your body. You're still doing a character. And you could see the five of us around those microphones. We're those characters, even though we're not dressed up and we're not lit, but our whole body is doing those characters. And it's pretty much the same as on-camera work, but you're just not being seen.
Right. And it was like knowing Mike Judge is, I guess, what led you to what became maybe your best-known role in Office Space.
I think so. Yeah, Mike had rounded up a group of us for the read for Fox. They wanted to hear it, and Mike said, okay, well, got a bunch of good actors here, so all of us went in and did three or four roles on that, except Mike was going to read Milton, and a couple of minutes before we walked in, he said, nah, I want to hear it, you do it. I said, oh, thanks for the prep. And he showed me the two-minute pencil sketch that he had voiced.
Now, this is something that you can still see on YouTube. It's like
You can still see it.
Mike
and
Judge
he,
doing
he did the voice.
Milton.
Yeah.
And for people who may not catch on to that, I mean, Milton was the guy in Office Space who's ignored and abused by his bosses and kind of a, I don't know, how would you describe him?
It's squirrely. It's what I think Lumberg calls him in the movie. But he's a squirrely little guy with mumbly, not hygienic. I think probably I had more stains on my tie than I think it stood up by itself. But this guy was not a not your typical worker that you would want to be around.
Right. So you're getting ready to go in and read for Fox, and so
right.
Mike Judge can convince him there's a movie to be made, and with
correct.
Virtually no warning, you're going to do this character. What'd you come
right.
up with at the moment?
Well, I saw what he did with the voice, and I said, I want to give him a lisp, and I want to make him quiet, which turned out to be what he wanted to do anyway in the film. He wanted to make it almost inaudible for this guy when he would make his protestations of, don't move my desk or I'll burn the building down.
Well, let's listen to what it sounded like. This is a scene in Office Space, film 1999. And your character, Milton, it begins with you speaking to somebody on the phone about how angry you are that they have moved your desk again. And he kind of goes on for a bit. And then his boss, Lumberg, played by Gary Cole, comes in.
The great Gary Cole.
It's terrific. Let's listen.
I said, I don't care if they lay me off either, because I told Bill that if they move my desk one more time, then I'm quitting. I'm going to quit. And I told Dom, too, because they've moved my desk four times already this year, and I used to be over by the window, and I could see the squirrels, and they were married, but then they switched. See?
Hi, Milton.
Milton, we're going to need to go ahead and move you downstairs into storage B.
No,
some new people coming in, and we need all the space we can get.
But there's no space.
So if you could just go ahead and pack up your stuff and move it down there, that would be terrific.
I was told
okay.
I could stay. Excuse me. Yeah, I believe you have my stapler.
That is our guest.
Poor guy.
That's our guest, Stephen Root, with Gary Cole in the Mike Judge film Office Space. You know, it's easy to overlook the little joke there that Milton saw the squirrels and he realized they were married.
Yes. Well, he saw them, yes, you know, having sex. That's really the only way Milton could make sense of that.
Office Space was not a theatrical hit, but it just developed this legion of followers on video. I'm one of them over time. When did you become aware that this was a bigger thing?
Well, when I would run into either Richard Reilly or Gary Cole or anybody from the set, probably a year after it came out, people would start yelling out things from the film. And I think it was Gary came up to me and said, "Are you getting this? Are you getting people coming up to you for this? Because this film was not a hit." But what it was the start of the DVD revolution in 2000. And word of mouth spread. But it was all about DVDs. That's the only reason this movie became a hit, was because that exploded right at that time.
What do people say when they come up to you?
Mostly the line that you just heard is, I believe you have had my stapler. That, and I'm going to set the building on fire. Those are the two faves.
Stephen Root is nominated for a Primetime Emmy Award for his role in the HBO comedy Barry. After a break, he'll talk about getting the role of the blind disc jockey in the Coen Brothers film Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album featuring jazz pianist Fred Hirsch playing his compositions with a big band. And film critic Justin Chang reviews the new film Brittany Runs a Marathon. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast comes from HBO's limited series Our Boys, the gripping true story of the tragic events that led to war in Gaza. In 2014, Israel is shaken when three Jewish teenagers are murdered by Hamas militants. When a Palestinian boy goes missing, tensions escalate into violence. Our Boys follows the riveting investigation and reveals how the Jewish and Arab communities were forever transformed, based on actual events. Watch Our Boys Mondays at 9 p.m. only on HBO.
You've become a favorite of the Coen brothers. And I thought we'd listen to a clip from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Great.
You're the blind DJ at a little country radio station in Mississippi.
And yes, sir.
This is the scene. There's one scene where you record George Clooney and the regular guys that are the heart of the film.
Correct.
Recording a song. This is a scene a little later where you're at the station and the station owner, I guess, drops by and says, "This song is a hit. We've got to track down these soggy bottom
right.
boys and sign them
right.
to a contract."
Right.
So the scene begins with you. You're at the turntable because you're still working, and you're introducing a record you're about to play.
Hang on, I'm gonna slap one on here, folks. Here's my cousin Ezra's niece, Eudora, from out of Greenwood, doing a little number with her cousin Tom Tom, which I predict you gonna enjoy thoroughly. Now, what can I do you for, Mr. French?
How can I lay hold of them soggy bottom boys?
Soggy bottom? I don't precisely recollect them.
They cut a record in here a few days ago with an old-timey harmony thing with a guitar company.
Him. Remember them? It's colored fellas, I believe.
Uh-huh.
Yes, sir, they're a fine bunch of boys. They sang in the yonder can and skidded.
Well, that record is just going through the goddamn roof. They playing it as far away as Mobile.
No.
Whole damn state's going apey.
Well, it was a powerful end.
Hot damn, we gotta find them boys and sign them to a big fat contract. Hell's bells, Mr. Lund. If we don't, the damn competition will.
Oh, mercy, yes, we got to beat that competition.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
That's fun. Our guest, Stephen Root, in the Coen Brothers film, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? This was your first Coen Brothers movie, was it?
Yes, yeah, it was a straight audition for Joel and Ethan.
You read for them, so...
I read for them.
What did you do?
Well, I came in, I had an idea of what I wanted to do, and they were sitting across from the table from me, a couple of feet away, and they said, you know what you want to try? And I said, yeah. Took off my glasses and gave him the one eye. trying to be the blind guy without really, you know, I didn't want to do any prosthetics or anything like that, but I kind of went into that, and they both jumped back about a foot. And I think at that point, I had their attention and went ahead and had a great time auditioning for them.
They're known for, you know, running a tightly scripted ship. They kind of know what they want.
Yeah.
Do you improvise at all with them?
But I mean, their stuff is storyboarded. They know exactly in their heads how they're going to cut it. So they like to get what they want to get first. And then, yeah, of course, you can do a couple. And they've actually used a, you know, one or two of the ad-libs that I've seen. I know they used a couple of Woody's and No Country. And so they're amenable to what you want to bring in, which is real generous.
You know, when I think of some of your memorable performances, a lot of them are Southerners. Did you spend more time in the South growing up? You moved around
a lot.
I didn't.
I moved around a lot, but not a lot of time in the South. But I ended up doing a lot of in my theater days in the 70s and 80s, I did a lot of Southern plays. In fact, the play that brought me to Los Angeles was Driving Miss Daisy. I got the national tour of Driving Miss Daisy with two of the greatest stage actors ever, Julie Harris and Brock Peters. If people who don't know the play know the film, the play is only three characters. It's Booley. And, you know, the other two. And it's, so to me, that was pretty much the greatest experience you could have. A 90-minute play, did it for 2 years on the road with two of the greatest actors ever. But that's a lot of time being a Southern character. And I did other plays that were Southern influenced before I did any TV or television.
Right. Do you think you ever sort of default to a Southern character when you're
sure.
given
up? Sure, I do.
Yeah.
I do, it's because it's fun. I think all character actors default to their stronger characters, and just in normal conversations, we'll slip into accents that we're comfortable with, because it inhabits us. I was going to say we inhabit them, but no, it inhabits us, and just comes out, and we don't think about it.
You know, you've worked with a lot of different directors, and all. You know, there are a lot of different ways to direct a scene, and I'm wondering what kinds of direction you find most helpful.
You know, as an experienced actor of 40 some years now, the direction I get mostly from really professional people is more or less. Less or more, take the air out of this and speak a little faster, or give me a little more of this intention. And the best directors pretty much leave you alone because they've cast you for what you can do. And your gut performance is hopefully what they're looking for. So less is more in terms of direction for an older, experienced actor. That's not true. For a younger actor, I really liked a lot of direction when I was doing plays. Tell me where you're going, where we're going to end up in 3 weeks, because you have a lot longer time with a director to do the minutiae of what the character is going to be.
Can you think of some direction you got when you were younger that was really helpful?
I think it was summed up best in the director that just told me to do less. It's like, stop acting and just give me the real person.
You also appeared in True Blood for several seasons. I mean, several mm-hmm. episodes.
Early in
the series. You're a gay vampire.
Gay vampire. I'm very proud to say that.
Yeah.
that was a role that came by. And I was like, this is exactly what I tell young actors to do. If you're a little afraid of the role, you should jump on it. So I jumped on it and really had a good time doing it. It was out of my comfort zone, kissing and the whole nine yards. And I learned a lot doing that role to really relax and just, it's like any other role. It was great.
Right. The guy you were kissing there was an actor named Nelson Ellis, right?
Nelson Ellis, yes. Brilliant actor. And he went on to do many more years of that show and a lot more intimate scenes on that show. But I think ours was the first that was you really saw an intimate kissing scene. And I think he was certainly more nervous than I was, because what I learned from this is it's very, very technical, intimate scenes are, especially kissing, because you'll approach from the left and you say, and Nelson, I'm gonna kiss here, then I'm gonna come out and we're gonna go to the right, and then we'll do a full open mouth, and then we'll come out again. So it was all very technical, which I think calmed him down as well as myself.
Yeah, it occurs, you know, that when I think of the roles you have, I don't think of a lot of love scenes at all, right? I mean, that's sort of...
Yeah, not much. Other than Rue McClanahan, that was my second kiss on camera.
Wow. What was that in, Rue McClanahan?
Rue McClanahan, we did, it wasn't Golden Girls, it was Golden Palace, the show that was on after Golden Girls. I did a guest star on that and was Rue McClanahan's boyfriend for that episode.
A lot of your performances have these terrific little physical tics or movements. Does that come out of any specific training that you have?
Training, I don't know. When I look at a character, especially when you're auditioning for a character, which I don't do a lot anymore, but you want to come in with a physicalization and whatever tick. I mean, like the guy in O Brother had the eye thing. In Barry, doing Monroe Fuchs, he has kind of a sideways back and forth motion that I just feel in the guy. He's always moving because he's a con man. Basically, and
slippery.
So,
right.
He's slippery, and I saw it myself do it in one scene when we're in a quinceañera shop, and the end of the scene, I'm just basically moving back and forth like I'm dancing, because that's the essence of the guy. He's slippery and he's an eel.
And when you develop these movements, like I can think of the bank manager in Seinfeld, and in Fuchs in Barry, his sort of slippery sideways movements.
Mm-hmm.
Do you typically plot that out ahead of time, or does it just happen when you inhabit the character?
You know, it just happens for me. I think there's probably something in the back of my head that comes out that I think of as a conscious thought, but mostly, I would say 95% of the time, my body goes there because of where the lines are, where the headspace of the character is. I don't even think about it. I mean, whatever character you're doing, your body just slithers into that. And for me, it's just great writing helps you physicalize a character.
You know, you've done such great work with a lot of ensemble casts, and I'm told you embrace the term character actor, right? You're happy.
Absolutely.
You're happy to have that, right?
I am indeed. I think the best of the actors in the 70s were character actors who got to do leads. You know, Dustin Hoffman and Gene Hackman and all these guys were character actors, but they ended up doing leads. And that's the kind of quality that you hope for.
Right. Do you want to have a leading role carry a film? Is that something you aspire to?
You know, I've really enjoyed kind of deep submarining into roles up until now. But yeah, it would be nice to be able to get into the meat of it. I feel like I'm able to do that on a show like Barry. I was able to do it on a show like News Radio and somewhat in West Wing as well, because I was on that for a couple of years. But to be able to do it in a film I'd love that.
Well, we'll look forward to it. Stephen Root, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
So appreciate it.
Actor Stephen Root. He's nominated for a Primetime Emmy Award for his supporting role in the HBO comedy Barry. The Emmy Award ceremony is Sunday, September 22nd. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album featuring jazz pianist Fred Hirsch playing his compositions with a big band. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Kroger. Did you know 1 in 8 Americans struggle with hunger? Yet 40% of the food produced in the U.S. gets thrown away. Kroger believes that if just 1/3 of that wasted food could be redirected to people in need, it would more than cover unmet food needs across the country while helping to protect our planet. That's what Kroger is doing through their Zero Hunger, Zero Waste Foundation. Last year alone, Kroger donated 325 million meals to local food banks. It's part of their goal to achieve zero hunger and zero waste by 2025. Learn more at kroger.com/ZHZW.
The yield curve has inverted. In the past, this has been an indicator that a recession is on its way. But will this time be different? Listen to The Indicator from Planet Money, NPR's daily economics podcast, to find out.
Pianist Fred Hirsch often works in small settings, as a piano soloist, or in duo with a singer or other instrumentalist, or with his long-running trio. Hirsch's latest album teams him with Germany's WDR Big Band. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Hirsch's intimate music scales up nicely.
Pianist Fred Hirsch is such a subtle interpreter of jazz and pop standards, you could overlook the fetching tunes he writes. The album Begin Again marks the first release of Hirsch playing his compositions with a big band, specifically German radio's WDR Big Band. Their arranger and conductor in residence, Vince Mendoza, makes a specialty of guest showcases like this. They're a familiar assignment for such European radio bands who do not phone it in. Fred Hirsch's Forward Motion, originally for quintet. Arranger Vince Mendoza has been working with the WDR Big Band a while and can make them purr and pop, and he brings out all their colors. Jazz big band language is often about dialogues between horn sections or between soloist and the band. Can get a little tricky sometimes, balancing the unequal forces of band and soloist, the many against the one. On Fred Hirsch's tune Havana, arranger Mendoza slowly pulls back the orchestral curtain to leave the soloist exposed and nicely set up. Fred Hirsch with bassist John Goldsby and drummer Hans Decker of the WDR Big Band. Vince Mendoza's orchestrations often have a quietly majestic quality they share with some other modern big band music. But a setting of Hirsch's Out Somewhere in memory of murder victim Matthew Shepard is appropriately dark, recalling Charles Mingus's stormy complexity and blues-tinged brooding. Thank you. Malone's WDR Big Band is typical of a few top-flight European radio orchestras, whose musicians are expert readers and blenders and adept interpreters of a wide range of hard and easy modern music. The soloists are not always so distinctive, but they're always fluent and often think compositionally, hearing their solo line as part of the overall musical fabric. Honors here go to trombonist Ludwig Nuss for his woozy wah-wah solo on The Big Easy. It's a good example of how everyone on the album Begin Again gets on composer Fred Hirsch's wavelength and amplifies his message.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and the Audio Beat. He reviewed Begin Again by pianist Fred Hirsch with the WDR Big Band. Coming up, Justin Chang reviews the comedy Brittany Runs a Marathon about a hard-partying woman who signs up for the New York City Marathon. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services. With a franchised network of highly trained agents and advanced marketing tools, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services network members aim to provide something more than just real estate. They think beyond the next transaction and build relationships based on your long-term goals to ensure you'll get all the value that home brings, year after year, home after home. All that more they do, that's home services. Start your home search at BerkshireHathawayHS.com. Support also comes from Teladoc. Have you ever needed a doctor late at night or while traveling? Teladoc offers 24/7 access to board-certified doctors for non-emergency conditions like a sinus infection, allergies, flu, rashes, and more. Teladoc's board-certified doctors can diagnose, treat, and where authorized, prescribe medication to be filled at the pharmacy of your choice. Download the app today or visit teladoc.com/fresh air.
Months after winning an audience award at this year's Sundance Film Festival, the comedy Brittany Runs a Marathon is opening in theaters this week. It's the first movie written and directed by playwright Paul Downs Colezo, and it stars Jillian Bell as a hard-partying woman who signs up for the New York City Marathon. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
In the terrifically smart and genuinely inspiring comedy, Brittany Runs a Marathon, Jillian Bell stars as Brittany, a 27-year-old New Yorker who decides to turn her life around. When we first meet Brittany, she has a dead-end job at a small theater and spends most of her nights out drinking and partying with friends. She gets in shape, takes up long-distance running, and decides to give the New York City Marathon a try. The title more or less gives away the entire plot, which just goes to show that unpredictability can be overrated. Even a formulaic crowd pleaser can be hard to resist if the formula is this well executed. You know the movie will end with Brittany crossing the finish line, but the point is the journey, the long, agonizing buildup to the race. The writer-director Paul Downs Colezo drew the story from a close friend's experience, and he confronts issues of weight, body image, and physical and mental health with a boldness that's rare in mainstream comedy. One day, Brittany visits a doctor, hoping to procure some Adderall for recreational use. The doctor refuses and instead gives Brittany a diagnosis. Because she weighs 190 pounds and already has high blood pressure and an elevated heart rate, she's in danger of health risks down the road. Brittany, with typical good humor, needles the doctor for fat-shaming her, but he replies that he just wants her to be healthy and advises her to start eating better and exercising. Brittany takes his words to heart, but it isn't easy to turn over a new leaf. She swings by her local gym, where she considers and then quickly rejects the idea of signing up for a membership.
We have a bunch of membership options to fit all your fitness needs with rates as low as $129 a month.
I'm sorry, I thought you said as low and then the $129 for a month.
Yeah, that's a starting rate, $129 a month, and for that you get access to everything in the gym except half of it.
That's so every person we've walked by has $129 to just give to you. Is there a sliding scale for people in debt up to their Okay. You do know that people can go outside though and just be outside and like do things.
Absolutely.
And that's the same fitness experience.
You know, you pay for our facilities.
But going for a run outside, that is zero. And then this one is, what is it again?
Brittany does eventually go for that run. And though she's left panting after just one block, she decides to stick with it. Her cranky neighbor, Catherine, extends an olive branch and invites her to join a running group. They befriend a third runner, Seth, who's as much of a fitness novice as Brittany is. Slowly but surely, everyone starts to improve. Brittany runs longer and longer distances and sheds several pounds in the process. She enjoys her boost in confidence and starts making new friends, lands a better-paying job, and even rejoins the dating scene she'd given up on long ago. But as good as she looks and feels, she continues to struggle with feelings of worthlessness and despair, and she has a tendency to push her friends away, mistaking their compassion for pity. You may recall the actress Jillian Bell from the Comedy Central series Workaholics, or perhaps her scene-stealing performance in the movie 22 Jump Street. Brittany is the richest, most complex role she's ever played, in part because her sense of humor is just one of her many emotional layers. We come to see how she uses comedy as a defense, encouraging others to laugh at her foibles so that she won't have to face them herself. If this all makes Brittany Runs a Marathon sound like therapy, I suppose it is. But some therapy sessions are more entertaining than others. Nearly all the supporting characters are on hand to teach Brittany a life lesson or two, but they're all so fun to spend time with that it hardly matters. Utkarsh Ambudkar, from The Mindy Project, plays a slacker artist type who gets thrown together with Brittany during an extended house-sitting gig. He's super annoying and totally charming, and you know from their first friendly spat that they're made for each other. Alice Lee makes a nuanced villain as Brittany's self-absorbed roommate, Gretchen, an aspiring Instagram influencer who superficially cheers her on, but seems to enjoy having, in Brittany's own words, a fat sidekick. And Michaela Watkins is especially good as Catherine, who seems so fit and successful and put together at first, until Brittany realizes she's going through intense emotional pain of her own. In less assured hands, Brittany Runs a Marathon might have been an advertisement for the benefits of weight loss, or a simplistic ode to the joys of inner beauty. But instead, it's about how personal insecurity takes many forms, not all of which can be conquered, though maybe some of them can. And since we're all messed up in our own ways, and just trying to do better, we might as well do it together, 1 mile at a time.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. Tomorrow on the show, tracing the course of the opioid epidemic. We speak with Washington Post investigative reporter Scott Higham about newly released federal data tracking the 76 billion opioid-based pain pills shipped to pharmacies over a 7-year period. The records come from a still unresolved lawsuit by states and cities against drug companies. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.